I'm very happy to be here and thank you for the invitation. I've been coming to Waterloo for 25 years, a couple of times per year, visiting John Wainwright, who's sitting there. And I've been here as a tourist at the Perimeter Institute, but this is the first time I'm going to speak in a professional capacity, so that's nice after all these years. So again, thank you for the invitation. I was asked to talk about some work I've done with some postdocs on dynamical systems for flat Friedmann models, for scalar fields and for FR gravity. And I'm going to spend two-thirds of my talk on that, hopefully, and one-third of what I think is more interesting, which is more connected to what David had to say in his talk. So I think that actually fits better. But anyway, these problems in flat Friedmann began because I was an examiner for Arthur Ahl, who is a collaborator here. And I was rather harsh at his examination. He had done what people typically do in these fields, and I said, you can do much better. He said, could we please do better? So, okay. I've done a couple of papers on that, and then it's for this paper is Sante Carloni, who has been working on FR gravity. He's Peter Dunsby's student, comes from Cape Town, has also connection with mine. So I said, well, also in FR gravity, not just scalar field, I think you can do better. So they asked me to work on that. So, okay, we can view it as a pedagogical example of how to do dynamical systems analysis. So just take the simplest example to see what you can do and what dynamical systems can give you, what kind of tools they give you, which allows you to understand the classical solution space of these models then. So I'm looking here at vacuum FR gravity. And the typical motivation is that you have to look at that because it's connected with quantum corrections, geometrical models for inflation, dark energy, etc. My motivation is different. I just wanted these as pedagogical examples for how to produce useful dynamical systems, which gives you access to a bunch of mathematical methods that allows you to understand the solution space of these models. So I'm going to look here at the flat Friedmann model, and with the simplest, very well-known FR theory, so just quadratic here, and vacuum. So these are very well studied. Still, I think there are things that can be learned, as I'm trying to convince you here. So you have a bunch of evolution equations, one for the scale factor and one for the Hubble variable, and then a second order for the Ricci scalar, and you have a constraint equation. And the equation for the scale factor decouples, so you get the reduced closed system of first order equations for H, R dot, and R, and a constraint, so two-dimensional reduced, and to use your word, gauge projected state space that contains essential dynamics. So listening to your talks here, I realized that I've been doing shape dynamics all these years. I've been just decoupling equations and not cared about them because I can always get them as quadratures. Afterwards, you have a different philosophical approach and say, well, you shouldn't even care about the decoupled equations. But okay, so if we look at this reduced system here, you see that it, of course, has invariance under time inversion. You have a very few set of fixed points, and fixed points are typically what people study because it's easy to do here, but it's quite restrictive that you have only a few fixed points for these models. Sorry?
What is
that?
Is the
Ricci scalar?
Ricci scalar.
Of
the special
slice? No. The full space-time Ricci scalar. So it's not, I'm going to come to that. It's not Hurawa-Litch, it's FR gravity.
It's great ignorance just to say precisely what a fixed point is.
So in this case, everything stands still, so they get constant
everything
values.
Stands still.
Yeah. Non-interesting things, you would say. But they are part of the dynamics, and it's part of the building blocks, so you should be interested in them. You can see that you have certain problems here. If FR goes to zero, things blow up generically here. So you can classify these models into if this, you have a model where F derivative of F is So the second derivative of this function f in action is larger than zero. Or if you have some zeros, you get problems. You get the state space is then fractured in different pieces. Also, what is typically done is to use Einstein frame formulations. So you can do a conformal transformation if f is larger than zero and get an equivalent problem with an Einstein-Hilbert action for a minimally coupled scalar field, where you get the scalar field in terms of this derivative of f function and a potential like that. And you can introduce a coupling constant kappa here if you want. But this is typically what people do. They work in Einstein frame. But this f equals zero here is in general not an invariant subset. And you can for these models in the Jordan frame. So if you take the dot derivative here of f, you get something is that is f on f equals zero. So it's only if this is zero, you stay at f equals zero. And this means that in general, there will be models that just go through this, that have some extension in the Jordan frame that just continues into the Einstein frame. So what you're doing when you're looking at the Einstein frame is to cutting off some of the solutions in two. And we are going to see that explicitly. So again, you can see a classification that you have models where f is larger than zero, then everything is fine. Einstein frame describes everything. And you have models where f can change sign, and then some solutions where you will only see part of them in the Einstein frame.
Excuse me, can you remind the definition of capital F?
So it's a derivative of f in action, the FDR.
It's a prime.
Here, next slide.
And dots are
time derivative of the proper time derivative in the Jordan frame here.
In which frame?
Jordan frame.
In Jordan.
I will only work in the Jordan frame until I come to the Einstein frame later. So I will give the full solution space in the Jordan frame. Okay, so let's restrict to this case. Well, you have this case, r plus alpha r2, and I chose an alpha larger than zero because if you have a negative, you get certain pathologies. I could handle that too, but I'm keeping things simple. Then the constraint equations look like this. And it's quadratic. It's a quadratic form in the variables h, r dot, and r.
What's the Jordan frame?
Jordan frame is the original field equations for this action.
What's the Einstein frame?
The Einstein frame is when you do a conformal transformation that depends on this, and then you get an equivalent problem for that part of the solution space, which is what people typically analyze when they go to all these models, that you can see this as a scalar field problem.
Okay, sorry about that.
No, I don't know how much you know. I'm a guest, so ask questions so that I can fill out the answers so that you understand. Because this is meant as a simple example everyone should understand. So if you don't understand, please tell me.
if you just add the R squared term, to some extent it's equivalent to Brown's sticky.
Yeah, there are lots of theoretical connections, and I would say local theoretical connections, which is I'm going to argue for here, that people just take this glibly, that I go to the Einstein frame and I've done it, everything. And that's not true.
There's also the issue that depends on how you couple matters. So
that's true also. That's true. You get different couplings, and you might prefer the Jordan frame because there you have equivalence principle satisfied, which you won't have in the Einstein frame and so on. And then you have huge discussions whose frame is the best frame and so on. Yes. I'm going to avoid that. Anyway. So this is an example of how you should try to get useful dynamical systems for this problem. So here we have a quadratic form in these three variables, and the natural thing is to bring this to a canonical form. But you also want to respect dimensional considerations. So you look at the proper time here as dimension length. We set the speed of light to 1, and Hubble variable is length minus 1. Ricci scalar length minus 2, R dot length minus 3, and this constant here has to have length 2 in order to kill, so that you get length minus 2 up here, just like this term here, so alpha is length squared. And then I take a linear transformation to new variables t and x, where I weight them with this dimensional factor, which I could set to 1, but I don't want to do that. I want to do it more elegantly. So I will incorporate this into these variables. So I just make this in h and r dot linear transformation so that all variables have dimension length minus 2, and then I get this constraint on this form here, which looks like a light cone in these variables. And this globally covers the original state space because the Jacobian determinant is just 1/6 here. You can see it already there, but if you want to compute it, to be careful, it's 1/6. So these are global coordinates covering the state space. Okay, simple idea. Look at the constraint, simplify it as much as possible, both when it comes to algebra and dimensions. Okay, so this is how the state space looks like for these models, this reduced state space. It's a light cone, and you have a fixed point here, which is the Minkowski spacetime. It's a fixed point which is totally non-hyperbolic, so both eigenvalues are zero because it's a conical singularity in the state space. So you have two disconnected parts of the state space here. They are related by this time inversion formula. So if I know the solutions of the top, I know the solutions at the back. But h is non-negative on the top, so from a cosmological perspective, I will look at solutions here. But if I know all the solutions here, I know the solutions here also for the collapsing phase, and this is the expansion phase. H equals 0 is actually happening on a line here, where t equals x and r equals 0. But this is not an invariant subset either. If you look at r equals 0 and you look at r dot, this is actually larger than 0. So solutions will pass through, if they come here, h equals 0 in these models. Okay.
You got two different t variables there.
No. There's one t variable, which is this. It's just along this line, but it's a positive. This is not the time variable. This is just a variable where I call. But I this is mini superspace for these models, and this is a time-like direction with respect to this mini superspace metric I could introduce here. So this has little to do with time.
But clock time is also t, but a different.
That's a different t in a different font. There you are. It's obvious. It's a different font, John. Come on. But this is going to be like a time variable for me eventually. Yes. So that's why I call it t. So what I now know in order to compactify the state space, I'm just going to look at that. I'm going to take coordinates which are circles on the cone, and then I'm going to keep track of the circles with this, basically this t function here. It's a fixed point here in the original system. So right. H and R. You are very good. So I had that. So the Einstein frame here is this part, which is gray, of the states of this light cone here. So solutions are going to pass, if they are here, they are going to pass from the Jordan part, which is not in the Einstein frame, to the Jordan frame. So Einstein frame just covers part of the state space, and it's not an invariant set. That is the point.
So what's the... In terms of the parameters of the model, what is it that's restricting for? What is the criterion by which you can pass between Jordan and Einstein frames? You mentioned this.
So this f derivative, the capital F, has to be larger than 0.
Oh.
And it's larger 0 on the gray part here. It's less than 0 on the white part, almost white part. And solutions are going, typically, they're going to go crazy here, and some of them are going to stay only in the Einstein frame part. Some of them are actually going to pass it in the state space. But now I want to the equations look fairly nice if I write them out in these T and X and R variables, but I want a compact state space. And I'm going to do it by choosing coordinates, so coordinates with circles here, and then a monotone function in T, which is goes from 0 to 1 in this direction, keeping track of the circles. So this is what I'm doing here. So I'm just projecting out the T variable here to dimensionless variables. You like dimensionless variables, and I pick a dimensionless T variable. This has length minus 2, this is length 2, so this is dimensionless. This goes between 0 and 1. And then I get a circle, top, and this function. So I get a cylinder here. And then I globally solve the constraint by just introducing cosine sine for x and s here. And I make a change of time variable, which is okay because this is between 0 and 1 here. And then I get the dynamical system looking like this. And it's completely regular. It's analytic. It's a finite cylinder, the state space, where T is by definition, because T, I look at T is larger than 0, between 0 and 1. But due to the regularity, I can include the boundaries T equals 1 and T equals 0. And this is important because asymptotic states, I would prove them, are going to be at T equals 0, T equals 1. So I get this compactified state space where T equals 0 corresponds to scry or null infinity in the original state space. And T equals 1 corresponds to the Minkowski point, which was totally degenerate. And then I go on, and I find, and it's not a coincidence, you can actually derive this from first principle, and this is analogous to what's happening in GR, a monotone function, which tells you that all solutions must originate and end at the boundaries T equals 0 and T equals 1. So it sort of foliates the flow, and you just have to go between them for each this variable. This function j increases or decreases here along this. And on the t equals 1 boundary, you have a periodic orbit. And on the t equals 0 boundary, there are two fixed points. Two fixed points that corresponds to what's happening at null infinity in the original state space. So they're not fixed points in the original state space, but what happens asymptotically at infinity. One is called R, which is a hyperbolic source. It has a desolation parameter equals Q equals 1, which is the same as you have a radiation if you have a fluid in just general relativity. So that's why I call it R for radiation. It's the same. It has the same geometric features. And then there is a point I call ds here because it's associated with the de Sitter state. This is a nilpotent fixed point, so it's two zero eigenvalues, but the linearization matrix is not identically zero, and there are known methods how to handle such in two-dimensional systems. There are known blow-up methods, so what you do is that you make a nonlinear transformation that blows up the neighborhood of this fixed point so that it becomes less degenerate. And then it tells you that there is really just one solution coming from these fixed points into the interior state space. And this is the so-called inflationary attractor solution, which is asymptotically associated with the Sitter behavior, which is what everyone in inflation is interested in for these Starobinsky models, which they are sometimes called. And as I'm going to show later, this that you have a center manifold structure explains why it acts as a kind of attractor for nearby solutions. But the real attractor, as we are going to say, from a dynamical systems point of view, is this limit cycle on the T equals 1 boundary. There are, not surprisingly, an open set that don't approach these inflationary attractor solutions, while there's an open set that does it. But all solutions end at this limit cycle at T equals 1. And you can draw a picture of this, or pictures of this. So this is how the solution space of these models look like. You have them on a cylinder, which I now unwrap. And then you see here solutions. This is the one solution coming from the desolation parameter equals minus 1. So it's a de Sitter-like behavior here. And this is the inflationary attractor solution. solutions coming near it. There's an open set of models that come here into this region, which only exist in the Jordan part of the state space and going into the Einstein frame. And there's an open set of models that all are remaining in the Einstein frame forever. So some solutions are extendable in the Einstein frame to the Jordan frame. Or if you want to live in the Jordan frame, you say, well, some solutions are cut in half when you go to the Einstein frame. Yes?
The attractive solution you find here, right, is the sitter solution, which has more symmetry than the non-attractive solutions, right?
Well, it doesn't have more symmetry except asymptotically here. But this is the solution. When I come to the Einstein frame, it's easier to explain it. So Einstein frame is good for many things, but not all things. In this case, you might worry, why don't you care about these solutions here for these particular models here? What's also happening is that when you pass through here, H becomes zero. And you are going around forever here. But H going to zero means that the desolation parameter blows up here. So you have an oscillation of the solutions where the parameter regularly blows up like this, going from plus to minus infinity at this line. Yeah. You like this as cosmological models? Well, this is actually happening here also for this solution. But from an inflationary perspective, you're only going to be interested in this part of the whole state space. That's what you are actually looking at, this part and only this part. And you don't care about what's happening in the rest of the models. So why should you only care about this part? What's so great with these models when you only care about this part? Okay. So let's go to the Einstein frame. Then we make this conformal transformation that gives you a scalar field expressed in terms of the Ricci scalar, and you get a potential looking like this. And what this de Sitter, the solution coming from the de Sitter point in this picture, it corresponds to a solution that rolls slowly from infinity, phi infinity, along this one, yeah, with a value which is exactly this plateau value of this potential here. And then it sort of oscillates here and goes down here. And other solutions are scattered, and then eventually they go here and so on. And you can do a similar analysis in the Einstein frame. You can show new variables, and you can compactify it according to similar arguments. And there, the solution space for the Einstein frame, which has cut off that part of the Jordan state space, look like this. So again, you have a solution coming from this de Sitter fixed point, which is, if I unwrap it like here, goes like there, and other solutions are coming here. And here you have more fixed points than I had before. Why? Well, because I have a coordinate singularity in the original state space. So going to the Einstein frame automatically generates more fixed points, which corresponds to that I have a coordinate singularities where my coordinates for the Einstein frame have broken down because they don't cover the full Jordan state space.
They lie at the border between the two regions.
Exactly. So this fixed point here corresponds to the solution coming here at the boundary, for example, of this guy here. Then you have a set which corresponds to massless scalars, massless state, which go through the which comes from here, coordinate singularities, so they start here.
Where do the solutions come out of the region that is not covered by Einstein frame? Where do they come out from in the other picture?
So they come from, this is what I'm going to say now. So they come from, they come from these fixed points here. This is those that are cut off, so to say. So this can actually be extended into the Jordan frame. And then you have the other solutions coming from our fixed points, which are all always in the Einstein frame coming from here. So this is what these fixed points mean here. And they describe the asymptotics, but they also tell you how you could match if you want to go to the Jordan frame, if I wanted to do it. So the Einstein frame here exemplifies a situation where only part of the Jordan state space domain is covered. So you have state space coordinate singularities in the form of fixed points here. And this is typically what happens with people in this field. They ask, for some reason, produce variables, and then they look at fixed points and the local analysis, but they don't examine the physics of the fixed points. If they did that, they would realize that some of the fixed points are just coordinate singularities, that they haven't covered the full state space. This doesn't mean that other coordinates are not useful. Global coordinates are typically not optimal for all parts of the state space. That would be too much to demand of them. So usually you can find local coordinate patches which gives you simpler equations, which makes analysis simpler in that region of the state space. And similarly here, I can choose these as variables, so I choose basically 1 over h square here, and then I choose a deceleration parameter and got much simpler equations than I had before. For that equations with the sign and all those things. Oh, this looks almost like one can solve them, no? And you start to try to solve them here. You try it. You're welcome to try it. I didn't manage to solve them, but they look tantalizingly simpler. But if you look at the Jacobian determinant here, it's 1 over h5, and we remember that part of the state was where you had h equals 0, so that means that we have flipped h equals 0 to infinity here, which we see here. Z goes to infinity. Q also goes, when h goes to 0, to from plus infinity to minus infinity. These are really useful locally, in particular for describing this inflationary de Sitter solution. But it's just not good at all if you want to describe the full solution space. And the situation is typically that you have shifted parts of the finite part of the state space to infinity. You have some coordinate singularities at other places. Here, if you try to do, I'm just having a two-dimensional system, so let's do a Poincaré compactification here. It would be disastrous, because this corresponds to that I cut up this light cone and pull it out to infinity, and instead of identifying it to the correct part of the state space, I would start to identify different parts of it, and I would get completely wrong conclusions of what the dynamics is for these models. You would be totally fooled, and this is typically what you see. Oh, I do numerics, so I do some numerical curves here. Yeah, it's just nonsense. You have done some identifications which are not respecting the original topology of the original state space. So, and this is a fairly nice system. Typically, you also divide with F and so on. That's a standard formulation you find in the literature. It's totally disastrous. Yeah, lots of fixed points correspond to lots of coordinate singularities. The important part of the state space have been moved to infinity. And then you do a fixed point analysis and say, oh, this fixed point is giving you the description of dark energy and so on. No, it's not. It's just a coordinate singularity. So you need for a physical interpretation. You need to know what you're doing with the original state space. And sometimes non-local solution state space structures matter. You want to understand what's happening around this fixed point solution. Well, let's do it like this then. So let's go to scalar fields in general. So you can, again, flat Friedman, and if you have a potential looking like this, where F is a monotone function. So this is work with Arturo and Juliet Hell from the Free University. Let's take the same example. Now you believe that this is your scalar field potential. You can have others. These are these attractor models. This is an example of these E models. So you have exponentials. So I can pretty much, and these are the field equation, scalar field equation for this. So now I want to investigate that. So let's look at heuristics here. What does dynamical system methods give you? Is it any use to do it? Can't I just heuristically see what's going on here? Well, I can see a lot. You have some damped, you view it as a point particle with a damping term here. So you're losing energy. You would expect that you drop down here. Maybe there's a solution coming here. But if you have solutions with high energy and losing energy, is anyone going to go to infinity and drop down here at infinity at this plateau or not? Is there going to be one going here? Are you going to have overdamped and underdamped oscillations here? Or are you just going to glide down here? This is an exponential. I know lots about the exponential potentials. That's simple. I can use this moving wall approach, which you were talking about here, of Misner, for example, and get the intuition for what's happening at early times of this potential, and I can get some more insights. But it's sort of scattered, and I'm not sure are all solutions covered, whether are the solutions going there or not. But with dynamical systems analysis, then I can get this state space here where at a glance, see, this is the whole solution structure. This is what's happening. There's a single solution coming from the de Sitter point here. This is the inflationary attractor solution. It's inflationary because it is a center manifold, which is a consequence of that you have to have sufficiently flat plateaus, scalar field potentials. They give you center manifolds that is degenerate fixed points. So you have a zero eigenvalue in the direction of this solution here. So you basically have power law dependence in time here. And then you have exponential approach here. And that's why they sort of catch up with this. So if you start with initial data here, they would be squeezed along this orbit here quickly because if it's a center manifold. And it has to be a center manifold because that's what gives enough e-foldings to go here.
Sorry, what kind of manifold?
A center manifold, which means that you have a zero eigenvalue for this fixed point. And then in this case, you have a non-zero eigenvalue, which exponentially push orbits towards it here. And that structure is typical for what's interesting physically when it comes to inflation. It has to be like that. But this also means that you have an alternative to the slow roll approximation as an example. The slow roll approximation gives you the tangency condition of this solution here. It gives you this part, this tangent here. But center manifold analysis gives you, I can produce a serious expansion for this solution, and I can do Padea approximants for it to get whatever accuracy you want for this solution here, arbitrary far. So this is the heuristic methods doesn't give you. It doesn't give you quantitative results. Dynamical system methods gives you an alternative to obtain quantitative results to any desired accuracy. You also prove what the solution space structure is. I don't have to guess anymore. I see precisely everything that goes on, and I can easily translate it into the original potential picture. So there are no solutions going to infinity for this kind of plateau. It needs to be flatter if you're actually going to land on a plateau far out. So I can approximate the slow roll approximation. I can also describe the late time approach towards the Minkowski state, which oscillates like that. You can do that with WKB approximations, but there are also averaging methods in cosmology where you use that you have a much faster evolution along this line than you have up here. You have two scales. And you can exploit that in averaging methods to get asymptotics for this behavior towards the Minkowski state. And I can even, and also for these other guys, here I can do Picard methods to get expansions for all these solutions. And I can actually match those approximations with the late time approximations. And if I so want, get approximations to arbitrary accuracy for the whole solution space of these models. If you want that, I'll give it to you. You might not want that, but if you for some reason do it, that's doable. So dynamical systems method nicely complement these other heuristical methods and put it in a single bag. But in my opinion, the main interest is that this is not just doable for this flat Friedman model, which are the favorites of people because there's fairly simple to do. I can generalize it to general inhomogeneous models, spatial luminous models, and I can even generalize this to the generic situation for inhomogeneous models to some extent. The full solution space of the full theory. And that is very hard to look at heuristically. What's more, I can tie the solution space structure to first principles that goes into the field theories that you're examining. So now I go into the last third of my talk. So let's look as an example, generic singularities in GER, but the relevance is for other similar field theories as well. So this is work with John since many decades. And other collaborators like Henk van Els, Mark Heinzler, Wei-Chet Lim, George Ellis, and my former students, and Juliet Hell at Free University, who is a postdoc who just has finished her postdoc and is looking for a job. She's very, very good. And I want to also point out another guy from Free University, who's really brilliant, who just took his thesis, which you can find on the archive, who has really blown everyone away when it comes to mathematical relativity about Bianchi-Tapp 8 and 9. He's totally outclassed us all. So he's going to be postdoc now. He started this Monday at KTH with Hans Ringström. So you can ask, why study generic singularities? Well, I believe that generic singularities has to do with extreme gravity, that strong gravity regime, and it's always interesting to see what happens when you crank up field strength. And you can ask, why do you want to look at this from a classical point of view? And this was my comment to David's talk, that doing asymptotics, of course we expect the equations to break down in some Planck epoch, but they're still, asymptotics is still going to describe what's happening way beyond this. As I said, I could use those asymptotics to get the global evolution, and you better be able to match the quantum mechanical regime with the classical regime. Moreover, as I'm going to show you, there are hidden symmetries. And I already 25 years ago speculated with Abai that one could use that in a dual manner, like you quantize gravity in the weak field regime to quantize in a strong gravity regime. And since those 25 years, I've been finding more and more of these hidden structures. So it's becoming increasingly interesting. When it comes to space-like singularities, you have this lore about, it's described by Belinsky, Kolatnikov, and Lifshitz, BKL. This is not the full story of generic space-like singularities. As you say, it's not the full story. So we are finding exceptions to that behavior. But it's still governed by BKL-like structures. So I tried, Belinsky was very upset when he said, oh, you're threatening. No, no, no. This shows a deeper connections, that there are hidden symmetries. What's more amazing is that you can generate the exceptions from BKL from BKL. And that means that you don't have this decoupling and so on. So do you have a... So I'm going to talk about things that the connection with first principles is causal structure and its consequences for asymptotic and extreme gravity. I should have... So if I take a singularity like this, space-like singularity, and look at particle horizons like that, along a causal curve, they are shrinking typically, and I call this phenomenon asymptotic silence. And if you just go down to a point here, you can't communicate with anything, and that's what's supposed to explain why you get BKL. I actually don't think we're talking about cosmology here. There are very good reasons, in my opinion, to believe that we're talking about generic black holes in collapsing matter situations. So the correct picture is probably more like this. And then you really see asymptotic silence, that you can't communicate outside the light cone. And eventually everyone sees themselves only. And
are you presuming that generically it's going to be space-like? Because again, there's all this evidence now for open sets of null.
No. This is also what I'm going to talk for. I'm expecting that typically it's going to be connected with a weak null singularity for a black hole. And BKL and the exceptions to BKL points at that. It's almost, in a certain sense, a weak null singularity. Why would it be almost a weak null singularity? I hope I have time to do that, otherwise I will explain it to you. If it wasn't about black holes. You don't want to be weak null singularity in cosmology. But I will stick to it to have it in the past because of cultural inertia. But I think this is totally misleading. The relationship between how much of this is going to depend on initial data, if you're going to have it or not. You can have a pure weak null singularity, which I expect also is a generic situation. And you can have a part of it, like Uri and others have speculated about. And you might also have an open set of models with a purely space-like singularity. So this is what and this causal structure is going to limit how this is why spatial derivatives don't matter in the BKL picture, because you will have this asymptotic silence. That would be the explanation that you have particle horizons that shrink to zero size. But we are finding exceptions to that, where you have real innominates, which actually are asymptotically distributional structures, which are trapped by this instead. So BKL doesn't see it because those are trapped surfaces of really innominate behavior. And this is what we call, or I call, infinitely recurring transient spikes. The dynamics within these light cones then, in this causal thing, is governed to a large extent by the principles of general covariance, that is the diffeomorphism group, and scale invariance. And their connection with symmetries, and that these symmetries are related to, that you have space-time isometries and homothetic symmetries, that they're Einstein tensor collinations. So they respect the Einstein field equations. And this gives you hierarchies of different models of different complexities. And what we're going to see that the diffeomorphism group and scale invariance act at each level in the hierarchy, pushing you to boundaries of boundaries to boundaries, making things simpler and simpler asymptotically, which allows you to actually in the end understand extreme gravity.
Space-time
scale invariance. So these are called asymptotic silence, that you have this shrinking. It's also, you can view it as an anti-Newtonian limit. Asymptotic BKL locality is asymptotic causal decoupling. You can have a breaking of that, like when you have a weak null singularity. This is not going to happen then. this also shows you that the issue of topology is a subtle issue. I call it, it's a matter of topological timing that is important. So yes, if you impose topologies from the outset, that will affect the diffeomorphism group, it will affect the number of degrees of freedom and the whole setup. But once you have done that, topology becomes uninteresting because you're not going to know anything about the topology when this happens. You only know yourself here in the end. If you look at different matter models, you find the connection with the causal propagation properties and spin, how they affect the singularities. So for example, if you have a velocity of light, like you have for a massless scalar field, matter and gravity balance each other. That's why you got this self-similarity that allowed you to do this matching. If you have an electromagnetic field, the Weyl scalar divided by the Ricci scalar is, as in that case, going to be order one, but you are going to have oscillations. You are not going to have fixed values. If you have subluminal velocities for a fluid, gravity is going to dominate. And for the field equation, gravity generates more gravity than the matter, even though the energy densities goes to infinity. So vacuum models become relevant because the vacuum equations describes what's going on. The matter fields act as test fields, asymptotically. So there seems to be that extreme gravity tees out the essential features of matter models. If we look at BKL then, and look at Bianchi type 9 and 8, you can do this Hubble normalized dynamical systems approach, which is not how we did it first, but you can take a physical metric G, and then you scale out the Hubble variable, and you expect that you have a singularity, and you see that say that you have some time function which is a simultaneous bang function, and you take some normal congruence to it. And you can construct a Hubble variable for that. So this is length 2, so this is dimensionless, this metric here, shape metric if you so want. I'm factoring out the length scale, which is natural to do when it comes to singularities for these models. I take the Hubble variable, which is the extrinsic curvature, basically, which is basically expansion, which is the only dynamical input you have in the singularity theorems. So let's use that. Let's factor out the scale that is naturally associated with a generic singularity. And then we look at three variables here, sigma I, which is the traceless part of the extrinsic curvature divided by the extrinsic curvature trace. So this is what I call, or I could use a momenta here, and I factor out the momentum, the dimension for that, and that's the momentum version of what you did for the configuration space. But the momentum picture is preferable, I would argue, because you get rid of some of the diffeomorphism problem which you have in the configuration space method, because this things, when you have this, you have double representations when it comes to axis permutations and so on. So you get a double kind of representation compared to what you get in a momentum space. So slightly simpler. When you do this, you find that the diffeomorphism group, the spatial diffeomorphism group, as imposed by space-time diffeomorphism group on general relativity and the scale groups, give you monotone functions in a hierarchy of different dimensions depending on which symmetry group you are doing when you are doing Bianchi models. And they push you from the general from Bianchi type 9 to Bianchi type 7 to Bianchi type 2 to Bianchi type 1. It drops down in dimension, the dynamics. It takes place on a big part of the state space and then up on a just small part because of this. It's not enough to actually prove this, unfortunately. So people have been trying to prove things now for, well, the first proofs was in 1999 by Hans Ringström, so for almost 20 years. But recently there has been huge progress by this student, Bernard Brehm from Free University. And he has basically proven what people have wanted to prove for decades, that BKL for this model seems to be basically right. There are lots of subtleties here. In your approach, you assumed what was so difficult to prove. Because you, when you did these figures here, you do have channels that go to infinity here, which you didn't write out. And the question is, are solutions going to run out into these channels or not? And BKL and Misner, they actually had this small oscillation regime and so on. And when you do billiards, you just skip that. You skip what you want to prove. But the proofs are telling you that this is probably right to skip it. So you are lucky. In this momentum representation, what has been basically proven, but it depends on measures. If a generic set of initial data behaves like this or not, it's really, really subtle. That's what's going on here. So there might be exceptions to this behavior, that some solutions actually in Bianchi type 8, which looks a little bit different, so you have a closed channel instead of the open channels here, a closed channel like that. One didn't have proofs for that, but this guy is producing them. The earlier proofs were top down. So you started with the general models and trying to prove that you went down to Bianchi type 2 and 1, which Hans Ringström managed to prove for Bianchi type 9, but he didn't say how. So he didn't say how. This guy is showing you how. You have a ring here, which because you have factored out this thing here, you have factored out this, so you have a scale invariant variables. These are the self-similar Kastner solutions. Self-similar solutions act as fixed points. Bianchi type 2 solutions become straight orbits coming from, and this is the interior state space, projected state space. It's four-dimensional, but we project it on these shear degrees of freedom here, which tells you the essential dynamics. And then you get the Bianchi type 2 solution taking you from one Kastner point to another Kastner point. And that gives you a law for how this changes, which corresponds to your bounds laws here, what you had there. This gives you a map, let's call it the Kastner map or BKL map, and that has been proved to have chaotic properties and so on. But that doesn't mean that the dynamics is chaotic, but this guy is showing you that there's a correspondence of the dynamics is chaotic. You can now add the three, you can do axis permutations, so the discrete part of the diffeomorphism group, spatial diffeomorphism is used here, and you can concatenate solutions. So you get the different Bianchi type 2 solution from that part, which starts here going there, and then you go there, and then you oscillate like this. Some solutions formally can go here, but what's in the proof is that this is actually not happening in behind type 9, so solutions are actually going to rattle around forever. That was so difficult to prove. And you're actually going to follow these orbits. So this guy is showing you that the set of code dimension 1 follow each. This is called a heteroclinic orbit when you go to one fixed point to another. And when you concatenate, you get a heteroclinic chain. And the real solutions shadow this. And it turns out that a set of code dimension 1 of solutions shadow each sequence which doesn't end up here. Basically, there are complications, but basically this is the picture that emerges. And this is not what BKL really said. They thought that you would perturb around that. No, really, each one attracts a set of co-dimension one of orbits. So now I could outstage you and do this Janos thing for any matter field, even electromagnetic fields and they're complicated. I would match the heteroclinic chain with another heteroclinic chain. And then I've done what you did. For if you have a stiff fluid, you actually get fixed points all over here. And you get a triangle like this, where you have stable fixed points. And those fixed points are what you match the solutions going around, and you match at another point. But I can match the heteroclinic chains instead, and I would then be a good shape dynamicist.
That's the cure.
So you don't have to just do scalar fields. I can do more complicated things with that too. So, not a problem.
So would you say, I mean, is this the case then that perhaps time reversal symmetry?
You will have the same thing here. You will have the same thing. You will have a singularity and you will reflect it and it will go up. Note that this actually gives you an arrow of time also, this, because you have just one unstable mode towards the singularity, but there are two unstable modes away from the singularity. So it's non-deterministic away from the singularities, these dynamics. The discrete dynamics that describe the asymptotic state.
So I haven't quite understood that.
The Casimir's 2-to-1. The Casimir is 2-to-1.
Exactly.
It's too quick for me to absorb.
This is just type 9, right?
This is type 9 and 8. He showed it to 8. So he showed it by, which was what I suggested to him since we have interacted for 3 years, that go backwards. And this is also what Liebscher and his other did for periodic orbits here, that perturb these guys and put bounds for it. And you need to follow the history in order to get bounds, in order to show that you don't get up into this channel, so to say.
Yeah.
And that's how you prove it. And that's what this revolution of new proofs, which show what you want to show, which Hans didn't do. So it's a bottom-up proofs, so to say.
So you say there's an argument you don't go up those channels.
That's what it corresponds to in the configuration space picture.
Yeah.
Asymptotically, you don't go out into channels. So asymptotically, you do the right thing. But that is what one has tried to, and one is not quite done yet. There are subtleties here. But still, you're in good, fairly, you're better shape than 2 years ago. 1 year ago, I would say. Okay. So I wanted to see, Bianchi type 1 and 2 and this is completely determined by the scale automorphism group, the spatial diffeomorphism in this. So I wanted to tweak that. What happens if you change first principles? And I came up, so I did an anisotropic scaling of Lifshitz type between time and space, and it turned out that I had rediscovered Urawa Lifshitz gravity, someone pointed out to me, but okay. And you can do this FR gravity. So again, you expect this network of heteroclinic chains of Bianchi type 1 and 2, there's the same symmetry groups. But what's happening is that these points, when you do these anisotropic scalings between time and space, move. So you either go out from or in, depending on your parameter. And you have a subcritical case for the parameter, and you have a Kasten circle. Bianchi type 1 is the same for these models, but Bianchi type 2 now corresponds to that to come from a fixed point like that, and then you end up at these three stable sectors. And you would think, okay, maybe everything ends up here after a finite amount of bounces, but no. The situation is similar to a Cantor set. So yes, if I just go here, it's at the end. But here I could go once, but I can drop all these solutions that go here. So I have to cut out a piece of this part here that comes to a stable thing. And I can do that iteratively, which is precisely in a similar manner, although it's not linear as in the tertiary Cantor set, that I drop down and get fewer and fewer parts that are left. But I am going to be left with Cantor dust. So non-generically, you are not going to end up at this fixed as the stable part. But on this Cantor dust, you have chaos. So generativity in this setting, in this more general theoretical setting, is a bifurcation. It's a non-local bifurcation where chaos becomes generic. And all these extra structures you have, in, like beautiful with Kästner parameters and continued fractions, are gone. Juliet had to introduce symbolic dynamics in order to do that, which turned out to be useful for these proofs of Bernard Brehm for relativity. So we had to go beyond relativity in order to fix general relativity. Okay. So this is my final slide, so time is pretty good. So there are certain trends and developments here. We see this, which I've been working on, both finite and infinite dimensional dynamical systems approaches, which are really powerful because of these extra structures, which forces you on just small parts of the state space asymptotically. I can say that similar things happen in Newtonian limits when you want to do that. So it's not just cosmology. We have found, or Weishet Lim in particular, then, has found solution generating techniques that connects all these things. And you couldn't have them if there were not hidden symmetries. So if you take these Gerock transformations plus discrete transformations, flipping axis and so on, and this is critical, then you can start out with a Kästner solution and you do a flip which gives you a frame rotation, which gives you a funny version of the Kästner solution. But that funny version as a seed solution for the solution generating technique of, for example, Gerock, gives you a different solution than if you had started out with a Kästner solution. And it gives you the Bianchi-Tapp 2 solution. So solution generating techniques give you the building blocks for BKL. But it also, if you take the Bianchi-Tapp 2 solution and twist it around so that you get the funny Bianchi-Tapp 2 solution, you get the false spike solution. So there's a gauge effect. But if you use that as a seed, you get a real spike solution. And those real spike solutions, to at least 12 decimals of accuracy now in numerics, describe recurring infinite dimensional spikes. So that also the exceptions to BKL trapped with huge innominatis, which I doubt could have a CMC slicing, they're also described by these connections. And that just wouldn't happen if you didn't have hidden symmetries. And these hidden symmetries, which you have asymptotically, you can ask, can you use them for asymptotic quantization or not? I don't know why one hasn't tried to use this in order to get sets of full sets of observables, for example. Which you could do for a hierarchy of very simple models to more and more complicated models, which you asymptotically expect to describe the full situation in GR for at least space-like singularities. Weak null singularities, I don't know how to do. So when Belinsky said, no, this is disaster. No, it shows you that there are even deeper structures. It can't be a coincidence that you actually can generate the full structure you understand here. And it's connected with this general covariance and scale invariance for how this works and these collinations for how you drop down from one level to another here. So there are lots of intriguing connections here. So I hope someone else will continue this work while John and I are too old to pursue this business. So thank you.
Some questions?
Everything was crystal.
The matter is a spectator near the singularity, right?
Sorry?
You said that matter is a spectator near the singularity.
Expectator? Well, matter, no. I said that different features of matter influence how the singularity looks like. So in particular, causal features and spin affects how the singularity looks like, which is intriguing. So extreme gravity seems to tease out some features of matter, that there's connection between matter and how extreme gravity works. But that's just seen in these examples. I don't know how far this goes, but it's certainly intriguing. Yeah?
So one thing I think I must have sort of really missed when I've been looking at these systems is you say that we have to be very careful that we don't hit these fixed points.
No. Some of the fixed points are physical, like Kastner here. They're really physical, interesting things. It's yes, you have to respect the state space. So in a given theory, you will get a different type of state space, and you really have to look at how does the state space look like I did in this FR gravity. You really have that light cone structure, and then you just can't quote out variables in any manner you want because it might not respect the topology of that state space. So for this model in general relativity, you sort of don't see these problems. But if I go to other theories, and people are going to modified theories, and I've seen this happening in several modified theories, you really should have kept your original variables or scaled with something different, because now you're really not respecting the topology of the state space you're having. So this is a thing one needs to think about, and therefore you should actually examine what is the physical significance of the fixed point. So you do your analysis of it, and you get the solution, and you can, for example, compute Weyl tensor, scalar Weyl tensor divided by Ricci scalar in order to see the ratios of what that means. Various physical observables, whatever observables are here, and to see what it actually means if you approach such a fixed point. Or if the fixed point is in the interior state space, and then it's actually a solution of the field equation, all the fixed points that are here are on the boundary of the state space. So they describe asymptotic states. They happen to be correspond to solutions of other models. The Kastner models are not modeled. So notice what I said about topology also, I forgot. So in order to understand Bianchi type 9, which has an S3 topology, well, the Bianchi type 1 and 2 don't have that topology. So you would be screwed if you want to. I'm just interested in S3. You would never, or very hard to understand models with S3 if you didn't go beyond that topology. You wouldn't see this, that the evolution is actually described by models with different topology. And the same thing happens in the infinite dimensional case infinitely more. So the spike solutions don't share the Gaudi topologies, for example, or the T2 models topology. But they are the ones that actually describe the evolution, asymptotic evolution. And it's okay because you have asymptotic silence for them. You are trapped, and it's exponentially shrinking the sizes so that you actually get the distribution in the end.
So are you expecting, in some sense, generic asymptotic silence? Which I think of as, you know, sort of an enhanced version of velocity dominated.
It's not just velocity dominant, it's oscillatory in general. Velocity dominance means that you actually get
maybe with the scalar field. But so within this vacuum case, I never know what to make of asymptotically oscillatory and stuff like that.
No, this is because you use
it. In
the inhomogeneous case, you use this velocity parameter, but it's nice. But it corresponds to actually a certain linear combination of these shear parameters. But it's too low dimensional to actually capture the full story. So if you look at the full quoted out momentum space like I'm doing here, you can actually describe how spikes and how everything works. It's good, but it's not enough in order to describe that.
And the frustrating thing is it's not even clear how one would set up a clear mathematical conjecture with that. In the case where you might expect oscillatory behavior.
No, I think
one knows how to do that in the velocity dominated case, but I mean these more
also,
general cases.
But this is what Bernard Brehm is trying to do now. Since he stopped in doing it for bottom up for Bianchi type 9, where you actually follow a whole heteroclinic chain, you have the same thing happening with spikes. You have an analog to that. And you can follow those chains too. And what it's trying to do now is to look at the PDE and bottom-up construct the singularity by estimates from this boundary.
Graham's work is purely in
type 9 so far.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, his goal with Hans is to do it for the general innominous case.
Okay.
For the what case?
The innominous case. So you want this normalization because you have this boundary, which is just a kinematical structure in a full state space. And from that, you can perturb it so you have small data. In Bianchi type 9, it turns out to be globally true. This is not going to happen in general, but you should be able to show locally that there's a local set solutions going there. So that's the goal, to just get the local results. Yeah, that would be great. And that is what you can hope to do, because you know it's not going to be globally true, because there are other behaviors like weak null singularities, Minkowski's basis, generic, and so on. So that's the best you can hope for, I would say.
Yeah.
Just quickly, the spikes that you see here are under control in the whole normalized variable, right?
They are all order one. So the variables like I had and which you matched here, it's the analog, they are order one, they are bounded. And so are the gradients when you normalize things, that they're also order one. And this is not a coincidence because, as I said, the solutions are generated from each other. So we have analytic expressions for them. We know exactly how the building blocks look like.
So every time I take a derivative, if I take that derivative over the Hubble, this is going to be a bounded quantity.
Yes.
So the Hubble normal.
The conformal orthonormal frame derivatives. So
yeah.
So you have an orthonormal frame for this metric here, which factors out the expansion rate.
Yeah.
Everything is finite towards a singularity, including the spikes and everything. And it's not a coincidence because they're all generated from the same solution originally.
Yeah, so when Adam and I looked at this in the densitized variables, we found the same thing. We just couldn't explain why. We had to conjecture that any polynomial with a derivative
right.
in it shrunk faster
right.
than any polynomial without.
So we have this connection with solution generating techniques, and that was used in numerics with Franz Pretorius and Wei-Chet Lim to get estimates for how you would do the numerics. So you know what kind of resolution you needed, which previous evolutions didn't do, so they're actually wrong. Also the ones with Lars and I, because it's exponentially becoming smaller and smaller, so it's very hard numerically.
Yeah.
But by knowing the building blocks, you could adapt the code to that, and that allowed you to do it numerically. So you numerically could construct the solution, which is what you want to show analytically also.
So you say you've done that with Pretorius?
Wei-Chet Lim did it with when he was a postdoc with Franz, yes.
Yeah.
And David Garfinkel. So that started doing that. But they have come further with that as well. So you want to do analytically what's now being done with numerics, which is based on that we know the building blocks, and then you want to sort of perturb it, just like he did for type 9, but for the general innominous case, and you start out with T2 symmetric models.
So do you have any physical intuition for what the observables corresponding to these hidden symmetries are in many of these models? You're talking about these hidden symmetries?
They are pretty hidden. and it's, the problem is with the solution generating technique, you don't know what you're getting when you're applying it. So what you do get if you continue to apply this, it gets solutions with more and more spikes. So my guess is that there's an open set of solutions without spikes, an open set of solutions with a finite number of spikes, and an open set of solutions with a countable dense set of spikes. And that, I think, is also provable for at least the Gaudi models.
Yeah, I mean, don't the spikes just occur when the local description goes from being Bianchi type 8 to Bianchi 9, right?
Sorry?
When the local description of the topology goes from being Bianchi type 8 to Bianchi type 9.
We have done it for Gaudi where you have T3 topologies and so on.
Yeah, 8, 9.
No, but you're doing a local description as an approximation as a Bianchi model, right?
No, well, that depends also. So there's also gauge issues, so it's more complicated. So there you have two killing vectors. And the more natural to use an Ibasawa frame, and that was a hard thing for us to prove, that you got generically without spikes the billiards of Damour.
Yeah.
And Hanoa. But that is basically Gram-Schmidt diagonalization. You can't do it in type 9 and 8. It violates their topologies. The question is are these gauge features just local, or is it more something subtle? But you get a different description, which is much harder. And the situation there, as in the Gaudemols, is more similar to the Bianchi type 6 minus 1/9, which doesn't have a Hamiltonian formulation, unfortunately, but it is, they are as generic as Bianchi type 8 and 9. And those more resemble these T2 symmetric models. And there are other complications. So I'm not sure that type 9 is such a great example as it's claimed historically, and what is really gauged. So you compute curvature invariance and so on to get some handle for it. And you can see that it's not gauge effects, because spikes are at the spike points, they're purely electric, while this corresponds to the Bianchi type 2 transitions, or the transitions you have here corresponds to gravito electromagnetic pulses, where the Kasten circle is purely electric.
Okay.
This is also the reason for why I think I'm talking about black holes, because I think when it goes into the black hole, you are going to crank up gravitational wave amplitudes. And I think these spikes has to do with that. You get basically standing waves trapped with amplitudes going to hell at certain points. And then how many you will have depend on your initial data. So you can try to get more physics out of it by looking at curvature invariance and so on. And they gave intriguing insights. But that doesn't tell the whole story, unfortunately.
Okay, so we're kind of already in the middle of the discussion session, so let's just thank Klaus again.